I'm Paul Soper, and this is the latest of my series of podcasts focusing on recent developments in direct taxation in the United Kingdom, intended primarily for practitioners, especially small practitioners. But if you're a reasonably financially literate taxpayer or an accounting student, you might enjoy it too, if enjoy is the right word. In the past, these podcasts have been prepared on a sporadic basis, but now they have become monthly, and so this is the October 2011 edition. You can read the text of this and some previous podcasts at my website, www.taxationpodcasts, all one word, .com. Some years ago, I produced a couple of podcasts, the first on residents and non-residents, and the second on domicile, and they were prompted by the case of Robert Gaines Cooper, an international businessman who claimed to have become non-resident in the 1970s and have taken up both domicile and residence in the Seychelles. And this was on the advice of his parents, who were both tax inspectors. Gaines Cooper's case has just reached the Supreme Court, so it's time to look at it again. The dispute which involves Gaines Cooper is a very protracted one and is a precursor to allegations by the Revenue that he had established settlements, trusts in other words, in which he or his wife had retained an interest, and also that he transferred assets abroad whilst retaining the right to the benefit of those assets, contrary to anti-avoidance provisions. So, where are we now, 4 years on from the first case? It was considered that his resident status was a simple fact on which a ruling of the special commissioners, who heard that appeal, would be binding, unless, of course, it could be shown to be absurd, following the ruling in Edwards and Bairstow, so that no reasonable body of commissioners could have arrived at that decision based on those facts. But his domicile status was a question of law, and further appeal was made by him, first of all to the High Court, who found that there were more than 20 different connections that he still enjoyed with the United Kingdom, so that they considered him to have had UK domicile in 2003-04, and looking backwards by extrapolation, had that domiciliary status as far back as 1992-93, which was the first of the series of years under appeal. Gaines Cooper, on the other hand, said it ought to be looked at the other way round. He claimed that he had taken Seychelles domicile in 1976 and had not subsequently altered it. Now, domicile is concerned with allegiance, and a taxpayer can only have one domicile in English law at any point in time. Had Gaines Cooper not been domiciled, he would only have been liable, even if he were resident in the United Kingdom, on sums that he brought here under the remittance basis. But of course, remember, from 2008 onwards, it is now quite costly to use the remittance basis, as those who are not domiciled but have been resident for 7 out of the previous 9 tax years now have to pay £30,000 per annum for the privilege, and from next April 2012 may have to pay £50,000 per annum if they were resident for more than 12 out of the previous 14 tax years. Now, Gaines Cooper did take an appeal on domicile from the High Court onto the Court of Appeal, but they simply felt that his counsel was simply re-arguing the same issues that had been raised in front of the High Court, and they dismissed his appeal. And they also refused him the right to appeal to the House of Lords. Now that might have been the end of our story. But in the meantime, Gaines Cooper had sought a judicial review of the residence issue. And if he could show that he was not resident, of course he would not be caught by the anti-avoidance provisions. Now, to obtain a judicial review, it's necessary to show that there is a matter of public interest, not merely private interest, concerning, well, maladministration or the legitimate expectation that government departments must act fairly. Now, the High Court initially rejected his application to them for the judicial review, but he was then successful in a later application to the Court of Appeal, who then joined that application with that from another two taxpayers, a Mr. Davies and a Mr. James, who were Swansea-based property developers, and they'd moved to Belgium, probably to seek to avoid capital gains tax, and had begun to work full-time for a Belgian company which they had established. Unlike Gaines Cooper, they had never appealed to the commissioners, and they had no binding determination of fact against them. They had sought their judicial review directly from a determination by the revenue, and their initial application to the High Court had also been unsuccessful. Now, although the two reviews were heard at the same time, the factual issues concerned are, or rather one should say, were quite different. Gaines Cooper is claiming that he had left the United Kingdom to take up permanent residence abroad. Davies and James, on the other hand, were originally arguing that they had left the United Kingdom to take up full-time employment overseas, but both of them claim that the revenue have not properly applied the rules laid down in the booklet IR20, which summarises the revenue's approach to the issue of residence, and that the revenue had also altered their attitude, so that although all of the claimants say that they followed the guidance in the booklet to the letter, they were denied the tax treatment that they sought. However, Davies and James have a further problem. Because although they claim that they left the United Kingdom to take up duties of a full-time employment overseas, they now accept, as a question of fact, that they initially left the United Kingdom in order to go on holiday in Italy. And it was only after the beginning of the tax year and after the end of that Italian holiday that they took up the duties of the employment. And so they were not employed for a full tax year overseas in the year in which their gains arose. Now, this means that they've changed their arguments a little, and their argument is now more closely resembling that of Gaines Cooper, that they had also left the United Kingdom like him in order to permanently reside for a period overseas. The Court of Appeal ruled that the taxpayers, and indeed the revenue, could rely on IR20, the revenue booklet, although subsequently this has been replaced by a revenue document called HMRC6, and one hopes that the same comments will apply to that. But they accepted the revenue's argument that they had not changed their approach to the issue. They simply stopped accepting claims for non-residents on the face of it, and had started to look at those claims more closely in accordance with their existing rules. The taxpayers now seek a ruling in their favour from the Supreme Court. However, they were only able to convince one judge out of five of the validity of their claims. The other four found for the revenue, and in doing so emphasised some very important points for those who seek to leave the United Kingdom and not to be resident here. To cease being resident in the UK requires a taxpayer to leave, but the Court of Appeal had decided that this meant something slightly different if you were leaving the United Kingdom to take up employment There, it simply implies that you get on a plane and go. It's the employment that's important. But that a person seeking, like Gaines Cooper, to permanently cease residence must have a sufficiently distinct break in the pattern of his life to show that he has left the United Kingdom. The same word, but a very different meaning. Now, Lord Mance, the judge who found for the claimants, noted that IR20 did not emphasise this distinction, did not explicitly state that the taxpayer should have this distinct break, and was, in his opinion, therefore misleading. He said this: "The primary issue in each appeal is how, on a fair reading, IR20 would have been reasonably understood by those to whom it was directed." However, the view of the other four judges was not in the taxpayer's favour. They found that the ordinary law, based on past decided cases, requires such a break to have taken place, and IR20 should be interpreted in the light of this requirement, even though it may not be expressly stated in the booklet. And they also felt that the taxpayers had failed to establish that there had been a change in the way in which the revenue approached the issue, despite taking evidence from leading accountancy firms, which did point towards such a change having taken place. The judgment now makes it clear that where a taxpayer relies on having left the United Kingdom, there must be a distinct break, something which has been identified quite separately in other cases, such as the ones concerning the airline pilots, Mr. Shepherd and Mr. Grace. But this, of course, is a binding ruling of the Supreme Court. The old belt and braces approach was to suggest that a taxpayer left the United Kingdom for at least one complete tax year, not setting foot in the UK at any time during that year, and then, like Dave Clark, the drummer, in his case in 1986, relocating your home outside the United Kingdom. It may be extreme, but it gives a greater degree of certainty at present. It is probably not a surprise that the revenue now want to introduce a statutory test of residence. Remarkable as it may seem, the word residence is nowhere defined in statute, and hence the very many cases on the subject and, of course, the uncertainty that stems from this. The revenue would like, it seems, to have an intelligent agent, in computer speak, on their website, so that any taxpayer could input their circumstances and have, because it's founded in statute, an authoritative statement of residence status. The current proposals, which were put out to consultation in the summer of 2011, will probably become law from April 2012. And if they do, it's intended that they sweep away all previous cases, rulings and documents in this area and establish statutory certainty, or so it is hoped. The legislation seeks to identify three classes into which a taxpayer may fall. The first class, those taxpayers who are conclusively not resident in the United Kingdom. The second class, those who are conclusively resident in the United Kingdom. And where a person satisfies conditions in both of these classes, non-residents will take priority over residents. And then there will be a third class where a person does not fit into either of the first two. And here, the revenue approach will be to identify connection factors and to also look at the number of days spent in the United Kingdom. Let's take a look at the first class. Taxpayers who satisfy any one or more of these conditions will conclusively not be resident in the United Kingdom. So, either. A person who is not resident in all three preceding years and is present for less than 45 days in the current year. Or a person who is resident in one or more of the previous 3 years, but present for less than 10 days in the current year. Or a person who left the United Kingdom for full-time work abroad if they spend less than 90 days in the United Kingdom and do not spend more than 20 days working in the UK. This suggests that visitors can only come for up to 45 days without fear of being classed as resident, whereas they could come for up to 182 days under the current approach. Exceeding the 45-day limit will place them in the third class, where the number of connection factors will then become relevant. However, the 10-day rule for a person who had been resident previously is helpful because it suggests that it's no longer necessary to take that belt and braces, don't set foot in the United Kingdom at all approach. And note also that each year can be taken in isolation rather than over a 4-year period, as is applied at present using the 90-day average rule. The second class are those who are, like most of us, conclusively resident in the United Kingdom. So, either present in the UK for more than 182 days in a tax year, or the same as at present. There's no change there then. Or only has one home, and that home is in the United Kingdom. Or has a number of homes, all of which are in the UK. Or works full-time in the United Kingdom for more than 9 months with no more than 25% of the duties outside the United Kingdom. The home condition obviously takes in people like seafarers who may leave the United Kingdom for several years at a time, but who at the moment remain technically resident in the United Kingdom. At present, resident, but this could now change. Clearly, you could have a situation where a person has a home in the United Kingdom, their only home, but spends less than 10 days in the United Kingdom. And that, of course, satisfies one condition in each of our two classes. And this, of course, is when non-residence takes priority over residence status. The condition concerning full-time work refers to a period of 9 months, which could straddle two different tax years. Conceivably, the taxpayer might spend 4 months in 1 year and 5 in the next. At present, they wouldn't be resident in either. Now, they might be resident in both. However, where a person arrives in or leaves the United Kingdom, that year will be subject to a statutory split-year treatment to prevent it operating unfairly, which at the moment, of course, is only a concession. Where a taxpayer does not satisfy any of the conditions in Class A or Class B, they fall into Class C, and now it's necessary to consider the connection factors. These are applied in a slightly different way, depending on whether you are arriving in the United Kingdom or leaving the UK. For people arriving, the connection factors are having a family resident in the United Kingdom, having accessible accommodation where use is actually made of it, carrying out substantive but not full-time work, whether employment or self-employment, in the United Kingdom, and presence in the UK for more than 90 days in either of the two preceding years. For people leaving the UK, these factors are also linked together with a fifth: spending more time in the United Kingdom than in other countries. And incidentally, Robert Gaines Cooper spent more time in the United Kingdom than he did in the Seychelles, which can't have helped his case. Then, having determined how many factors apply in a particular case, we count the number of days spent in the UK. Hence, if you are arriving in the United Kingdom and you spend less than 45 days here, you are not resident in the UK. If you spend at least 45 days, but less than 90 days, you'll be resident if all four of the factors are satisfied. In the United Kingdom for 90 days, but less than 120, resident if three or more factors are satisfied. Spending at least 120 days in the United Kingdom, but less than 183 days, resident if two or more factors are satisfied. Oh, and of course, 183 days or more, and you're resident in the United Kingdom anyway, under Class B. If you're leaving the United Kingdom, all five of our factors come into play. And if you spend less than 10 days in the United Kingdom, you'll be non-resident, of course. Up to 44 days, resident if you satisfy four or all five factors. Up to 89 days, resident if you satisfy three or more factors. Up to 119 days, resident if you satisfy two or more factors. And finally, up to 182 days, resident if you satisfy one or more factors. Whilst this should provide greater certainty, taxpayers who are not in the first two classes may find it practically difficult to manage the permutations of connections and days that need to be looked at. At present, if a person leaves the United Kingdom and returns within 5 years, a liability to capital gains tax arises on the disposal during that period of assets owned when leaving the UK. And it's proposed now to extend this to certain sources of investment income as well, particularly dividends from close companies. Those are companies that are small enough to be manipulated to obtain a tax advantage. However, this will not apply, we're told, to earnings from employment or self-employment. So surely there's a simple way round this. Don't you pay remuneration from the close company rather than a dividend? Or is that too simple? The consultation also suggested that as only a very small number of people now use the remittance basis, it may not be necessary to retain the concept of ordinary residence, but this clearly does need further exploration. You should also note that the Gaines Cooper case and the proposals for a statutory residence test do not affect the issue of domicile, even though 23 years ago the Law Commission suggested that the UK concept of domicile was so out of date it needed urgent reform. This podcast was presented, written, and produced by Paul Soper, who asserts copyright therein. The full text of this and my other podcasts can be read at my site, www.taxationpodcasts.com. For further details of podcast production, particularly if you would like me to create them for you, contact me at paulsoper, all one word, at mac.com. And so, until next month...